both sacred and secular, today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Diane Pritchard is both a pastor and a writer. We'll ask about combining those jobs on Scribble. Should mention also, you were also a teacher.
Yes, for 33 years.
My God, what prompted you to move from the teacher's desk to the pulpit?
Well, short answer, Holy Spirit, of course. That's what I'm supposed to say. But I guess when you teach language arts, you're supposed to be good at all modes of language. And so our pastor was going to be gone for a Sunday, and he said, Diane, would you preach in my place? And here's a prepared sermon, and I read his sermon, and it didn't make any sense, so I read my own. I wrote my own and read that. And as I was shaking hands with everybody as they left, Matilda Hilmer said, you've missed your calling. And I thought, oh, come on, I'm a really good language arts teacher. you know me better than that. But that's where it all started. Then it went on through a series of more church work, and eventually I went to a lay education school that was offered at the time by the United Church of Christ in the Iowa Conference, and graduated from that and did a lot of supply preaching and ended up being called to serve two small congregations.
Is that becoming more and more a situation where you are pastor of two congregations mm-hmm. rather than one?
Yes, that and also second career.
Yeah.
It's not unusual.
That is, in fact, more usual, isn't it?
It is.
Unusual.
Now it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation. And it occurs, I guess, in all religions, doesn't it?
It does. I was in the United Church of Christ for quite a long time, and then I got called to a Lutheran church, so I'm being re-Lutheranized right now via Wartburg Seminary. And so for both denominations, a lot of second career people and a lot of two-point parishes.
Do you share buildings or are they individual church buildings?
Very individual. Mm-hmm. Very individual.
And are the congregations quite different in the makeup? Or
On the surface, no. They're small town people, rural
right.
people, yeah. But the different personalities, each congregation has its own personality.
So do you have to adapt the? Do you preach the same sermon at both?
I do, and I have to be careful of that because one congregation is very small, and one is not. It's also very small, but larger, and is more active. So I have to be careful that I don't say things about the smallest congregation that actually apply to the larger congregation,
right?
Like our mission work or whatever that might be. But it's generally not much of a problem.
I was going to say, maybe you just change the length of your sermon.
they're not that lucky.
Do you ever find yourself, since you've got two audiences that differ slightly, do you ever find yourself writing for one of the audiences rather than you can't
yes.
write for people in general, right?
Yeah, I usually write for the larger congregation.
And then adapt it a little bit?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Have you ever written a sermon for one person in the audience?
I have not done that. Pastors get accused of that quite often, but it hardly ever is the truth. It's not really what happens. It's just that it's how it falls on the ears.
Go ahead.
So how do you decide then? It seemed teaching has the same problem. I taught American Lit for, 39 years. And any given class of American Lit, the American novel, for instance— there would be people just beginning and people very sophisticated mm-hmm. who've read mm-hmm. a lot. How do you decide where to aim your sermon?
Okay, now we're talking about maturity of faith. And that is challenging. And the first thing I have to remember is to not take anything for granted and to also not think that they're not smart enough to understand something that I've learned in seminary. I have to assume that everyone is going to get something out of what I say. As a person who sat in the pew for years, I sometimes was kind of insulted by sermons because I thought, you went to seminary, it sure doesn't show. You know, so I want to make sure that I share my learning because I think people really appreciate that. They want to understand their faith, at least for that hour on Sunday morning. It's more than going through the motions. If you're in church nowadays, sitting in a Sunday morning service, you're there very intentionally. It's not just because you have to go or because everybody else does. You've made a decision. Right. So I have to respect that decision and provide as much as I can during that time.
Congregations really can be different, can't they?
Oh, yes.
I know a while back I was talking to a Catholic priest, and he said, how would you like it if you were you're reading a letter from the bishop, and in one mass, people applauded, and in the second one, people got up and left.
Yeah, it could happen. It could happen. Well, and I'm caught. I'm a fairly politically active person, and so I'm caught in that trap now also, and so I have to be very careful about being maybe sounding too political. Although I'm thinking it sounds very Jesus-y. You know, I don't want to make anybody think that I am supporting one party or another.
Except Jesus sounds political these days.
Oh, you think?
Well, there are people that don't, though, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah, well, I had lunch with a pastor friend one time, and I said, well, I'm sure that Jesus was a Democrat. She said, well, I'm sure he was a Republican. There we are.
I've read some biblical commentators and analysts. There was one who contended that Jesus was a Pharisee. And he detected from, you know, what he read about Jesus that he was, and that's why he liked to argue with the Pharisees, because that's what they did.
Well, that's interesting. It's probably more that they had the same level of education and knowledge. Well, actually, probably Jesus was smarter, more informed, but...
Well, you know, that's another thing, too. Most biblical analysts take it as given that Jesus was illiterate. And that the apostles certainly were.
Certainly the apostles.
Yeah, and you don't know how to square that because and it's true that back in those days when there was not much literacy to go around, people had great memories.
Yeah.
And could commit the whole, all the writings to memory.
Yeah.
A skill that we've largely lost today.
True.
But, when did you decide to start writing a column?
It just happens every once in a while. Letters to the editor don't give me enough words. And so I've become friends with a couple editors. And when I have something that I think they like, then I share that. It's just something that I think people should think about. So if I, and it's usually has to do with politics, with how, and let me just start with this. Politics, the basic meaning of politics, one basic meaning is it's simply how groups of people make decisions. So we're raised doing politics, talking politics. Every family makes decisions as a group. Every organization, every business makes decisions as a group. So we are all political creatures.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get it mixed up sometimes with party loyalty or with very narrow points of view about one group decides or believes. And that's where it gets tricky.
Well, that Don gave me a sample of column of yours from a while back, and it's the one in which you really sound conflicted, like there might horrifyingly be two Diane Pritchards, right?
Yeah.
One in the pulpit. And
yes, apparently. Yeah, that was brought out to me by my congregation. I have a good friend who's running for Congress, and she asked me to be in a commercial with her. I've worked on all of her campaign committees. We've been friends for years. And so I said, of course I will. And then after that, I thought, oh, I better check with my congregation because they're touchy about politics, what they think of as politics.
Right.
And when they think of politics, they think red and blue.
Right.
And so I checked with my congregation, and I said, I don't want to put any of you on the spot. I don't want any of you to be embarrassed by your pastor appearing in this commercial. And so what do you think? And it was interesting because what I got was basically what you do on your own time is your business. As if I were only a preacher on Sunday and right. I was something totally different. And to me, that's totally missing the point of being a Christian or of being a member of any faith group.
Right.
Is that it's not just a piece of decoration on your resume. It's not just something you do because it makes you feel good once in a while. It's something that's supposed to be lived all the time, that you're supposed to be cognizant of all the time. It's talking about, if we want to use Christian terms, you're living out your baptism every day. You know, Martin Luther said, whenever I wash my face in the morning, and I'm glad he did, he said, I'm thinking of my baptism. And I wish we could all do that. And Paul says something about, you know, everything you do, do in the name of Jesus Christ. And wouldn't that be amazing? Now, I think there's still some disagreement there. I think a lot of people do things in the name of Jesus Christ that I think are horrible.
Right.
So it's hard to know how to approach people sometimes without offending them. But so far, my congregation, though, I was so disappointed, though, when they said, well, whatever you do on your own time is, you know, that's fine with us, meaning whatever we do on our own time is none of your business.
They need a sermon.
Oh, they're going to get one, yeah. No, that's probably going to be my focus now for the next few months or years, is how to help them have a more mature faith, to understand that when you're baptized, it's not just a good luck charm. It's something that requires quite a bit of you if you take it seriously. It requires thought and action. It requires, well, the Lutheran point of view is that we are freed from sin by Jesus Christ and we are freed to be good to our neighbor. It doesn't stop with the freed from sin. It goes on to you are freed and actually impelled to be good to your neighbor, and not just the neighbors you like, but the ones that you don't understand, the ones that disgust you, the ones that are far away or just around the block, the ones who have hurt you. And that's very hard to swallow. It goes against human nature in many ways.
You know, to move the problem of differences into the shallow end of the pool, I sometimes think of the passionate following that people have for athletic teams.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Cubs and the Cardinals, or move it closer, the Bears and the Packers.
Yes.
They apparently cannot see any good in the other team, and yet it's just football. To try to discuss just playing football and get away from the labels mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the passion that goes with that mm-hmm. loyalty, or you can call it a crazy kind of faith. It's just human nature. We tend to choose sides. I don't know why, but we have to take sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then that makes discussion of fundamental issues difficult.
Yes, it does. Well, I think sports is one of the religions of this country. It's
right.
It's definitely a religion. It has all the hallmarks of a religion, an established religion. Which maybe explains why, if you drive between a high school gymnasium and a church on a Sunday, which parking lot is fuller?
I see a column coming up here.
I had the pleasure of doing that for many years.
Okay. Right.
It's frustrating. In fact, I suggested to our church council that, you know, we should offer little chapel services over in the high school while all those teams are there, because all of those people, knowing where they come from, consider themselves good Christians or nominal anyhow. And if we would offer a little chapel service, a little worship service, because there's a lot of downtime when you're playing in those tournaments, we could offer something special. It never happened, and I'm not interested in doing it anymore, but maybe somebody will someday.
I can't believe that God cares whether or not you get a touchdown. I just... That bothers me. I think there's some things we do on our own. And while, you know, religion illuminates most of our actions, or at least if you are a believer, it certainly does, I think you can carry that a little bit too far.
Yeah, yeah.
Who do you imagine the reader of your columns is? I mean, do you have an imaginary... And is that different from the person sitting in the pew?
I imagine that it is a person who is maybe somewhat like me, someone who's interested in politics, someone who finds that very important. I have a lot of acquaintances who think that politics is dirty, that you should stay away from it. And my argument is, if you stay away from it, if you don't try to be part of the system, it will continue to be dirty. If you think it's dirty, then maybe you should do something about cleaning it up. And so I guess part of my goal is to get other people active and interested in politics and see the good of it rather than the struggles or the challenges or the discomfort that it causes.
Do you deliberately use a different style in your column than in your sermon?
Not really. Mm-mm.
No, you're preaching on paper or in word, huh?
Yeah.
I believe with Aristotle that politics is one of the noblest professions you can follow. And yet, if you talk to most citizens, they think our politics is debased. Mm-hmm. And there's pretty good evidence that it is, that it's run by money. But the thing is, citizens stand still for that.
Yeah.
They'd rather complain about politics than do anything to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I've never understood that. If you could somehow get the money out of politics, it would be cleaner.
Yeah. Well, and if you just get more people involved on the local level, the all politics is local. Who is that, Tip O'Neill? Or somebody famous?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And it is local. Having worked with a candidate for so many years, I see how she works on the local level. When we first started campaigning, she would go door to door, and I would drive, and she would go around the block. And pretty soon I lost track of her, and I think, oh, where'd she go? I've lost her, and I drive around looking for her. She was always at somebody's kitchen table, learning their life story, and then saying, this is how I can help you. And it might have been an agency that was in place already, or it might have been something that she said, I will try to do when I'm elected. And that's the charm of politics right there, is that one-on-one. And I wish we could see more of that, of people getting to actually know their candidates one-on-one. But numbers, it's impossible.
Right.
And, of course, with COVID now, it's you don't go door-to-door at all. And all you get to do is call people and ask for money 12 hours a day.
Yeah, well, it's very true that people want that personal contact with politicians. But the downside of that is they believe a politician should think exactly the way they do.
Oh, yes.
And when you're serving several thousand people,
mm-hmm.
you can't do that. It seems to me the proper attitude is that I want to hire somebody to work for me who will do his or her best to act on the evidence. And that's what I thought we should always do as legislators.
Yeah, yeah. You, well, you've had lots of experience with this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed sometimes that when we would have evidence presented in committee that people would go back to a set political position in making a judgment. And I'd say, well, you're not following the facts here. And if you follow the facts, it'll cause you to vote on things. Sometimes it might upset a majority of people in your district because they weren't there to hear.
Yeah.
And you have to trust a legislator or a congressperson or somebody on the city council to use their best judgment based on the facts. And that is hard for people to accept. And now it's gotten to the point where politicians don't bother. And that is a worrisome thing.
It is. And I know people always complain about the ads to me, and I say don't worry about the ads. They're not going to give you any information that's useful, but look at the platform. Look at the person's platform. But even that is no guarantee, because that platform doesn't always go very far, or the person doesn't have the ability or the power as a newly elected congressman to get very far with something.
Well, mainly, it's hard to find the platform because they're so busy knocking each other mm-hmm. in their ads.
Yeah, you have to go right to their website.
I know why so-and-so doesn't like so-and-so. But yeah. I don't know,
I know
what she has to replace it with.
Well, and my husband and I were just talking about this. If only all the ads were paid for only by the candidates and not by the outside special interests, that would make a big difference, too.
You know, I remember back in the day, let's see, I started in television in, way back in the 50s, early 50s. And in those days, when you brought in an ad, they checked it for veracity.
Interesting.
And if nothing could be, you know, if they were saying something that sounded fishy or phony or false, they wouldn't run the ad. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court a few years later, and it was the Supreme Court that says you cannot censor political speech. And that opened the door for all the garbage we have now.
Yeah.
And it's one thing not censoring political speech on the stump, but put it on television, and that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, it's so misleading.
Yeah, it's really tough. But how often do you write a column?
Oh, dear. Maybe once a month. It's very irregular. It's just whenever I am moved to do something. If something moves me, then I think people need to think about this some more and look at it from this point of view. And maybe I can help somebody to understand something a little better. We need to do a lot more of this helping people to understand better. I have a daughter who's a therapist, and she uses the line all the time, tell me more. If somebody says something that you think is ridiculous, the first thing you say is, tell me more. Hmm. And then, quite often, when they start to tell you more, they can't tell you anything. And the intended goal of that is, maybe I'll check that out. Maybe I will look up that source. Maybe I will see what I can find about this statement, about, you know, ask who told it to me and why did I believe them. I think we need to question each other more when we make statements. If I say something, then somebody needs to say to me, tell me how you know that. Or if I hear somebody say something derogatory about an issue or my candidate or a group of people, I have to say, tell me more about that. How did you come to that? And I think if we get people to examine their own beliefs instead of just spouting off things that they've heard or seen someplace, I think that will help our overall dialogue, especially with politics and decision making.
Well, I think that's true with all everything. I mean, you know, that's a good, I'm going to use that. So
I want to
get back for a minute to the sermon as a literary form. When you taught creative writing, did you ever try to teach a sermon?
Oh, no.
Why?
I've never entered into mine. I thought sermons were boring, so why would I teach them?
Well, if you had tried to teach a sermon without even thinking about it, there would be a huge groan.
Yeah.
I mean, I taught American Lit, so I would assign Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
Oh,
but
yes.
The minute I said the next assignment is a sermon, why is a sermon thought of so badly by so many people who go to church?
I don't know.
Because some of them are boring.
Yes, and it's because you don't learn anything new. I hope that my sermons always bring up some new way of looking at something or some new fact. It's really fun to bring up what I've been learning in my classes, some exegesis, some point of new knowledge of how. In fact, I had really good luck on Christmas Eve, and I call it good luck because people talked about the sermon on the way home. You know, which
right.
is like the gold star of all right. gold stars. And I had mentioned that possibly Mary and Joseph, based on some research, sociology of the time, whatever, the culture of the time, that they probably weren't alone because everybody was headed to Bethlehem. And if the house was full, that just meant that they would make room for them anyway.
Right.
And so they weren't alone.
Right.
And One family talked about that all the way home. That's what you want a sermon
right.
to do, is for people to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. There's also a thought that now that they've looked a little more closely at when Jesus might actually have been born, it was probably sometime in July in about 4 B.C., and they said they would have gone to a caravanserai, kind of a big tent thing. rather than to an end. And mm-hmm. then there are others who said, well, they never went to Bethlehem. They were
That's
put
possible.
There by Matthew. He was born in Nazareth. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there is no evidence. Mm-mm. That is the problem. And when people wrote back in those days, they wrote for a purpose. They wrote to, when they wrote the what we call the Gospels now, it was to tell a story that was persuasive. And all four Gospels are somewhat different.
Yeah. Matthew was very much interested in persuading the Jewish community.
Yeah.
And
definitely. And when John came along, he wrote a completely different story.
Oh, yes.
So it's just amazing that when you look at all that and then you try to make something coherent out of it all, you are never going to have a completely satisfactory answer.
That's right. And it makes it very easy to cherry pick, too.
Yeah.
Which is a danger. Yeah, you have to look at the whole story. And a lot of it goes back to faith. You know, there are days when I think somebody thousands of years ago decided that there needed to be this particular kind of God. There are already all kinds of gods, but we needed a God who was a little different. And the Christian God, the Jewish God, is a little different in that he didn't walk among humans just to have some fun like Zeus did. This God, he or she, didn't expect humans to be the servants and be subservient. There are so many things that are unique about our God, but was that just somebody's great idea and it stuck? I mean, that's how shallow my faith is sometimes, is it's just somebody made this up and then a whole bunch of old men kept it going for years and years and years.
Do you think your sermons would be better if your faith were stronger or not?
I don't know, because my sermons are based a lot on my questions and my wonderings. How can this be? And it quite often just starts out with a sermon of when I write, it starts out with not being sure of what this is all about and what it means to us nowadays. And so as I write, you know, one of my mottos right. is writing is a way of knowing.
Right.
If you write,
right.
that's a way to find out what you know. It's like reading your own mind.
Rather than to report on mm-hmm. what the facts are.
Yeah.
I always say I never know what I think till I hear what I say.
Well, that's,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's,
of course, yeah.
I think any good piece of mm-hmm. writing does that.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar at all with Mother Teresa's journals?
About her doubts and her...
Real doubts,
mm-hmm.
right?
Very
I mean,
real.
She
mm-hmm.
went through huge periods of darkness.
Yeah, and I don't know that she was ever reassured. I don't know that she died.
Well, I'm not sure anybody is.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can't live with doubt, you can't live in peace. That's for sure.
Yeah. Who said that doubt is not the opposite of faith? It's the same thing.
Before we run out of time here, what are your congregations again?
Hope Lutheran in Dixon, Iowa, and Community Church of Toronto in Toronto, Iowa.
Okay. So if you want to hear some interesting sermons, those are the places to go. Do you keep yourself on some kind of a schedule of writing regularly once a month?
No. I just write whenever I feel like it.
Okay. Well, we're about to finish our whole sermon here. Diane Pritchard, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
You're very welcome.
And keep writing and preaching.
Okay.
I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you for being with us. Join us next week for another session of Scribble.